This chapter on the droids, we talk about The Mandalorian, Chapter 5, The Gunslinger, as we continue our breakdown of the brand new series on Disney+. What's going to happen to Baby Yoda this week? Welcome back to the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. Alongside Sam, I am Mike, and we're ready for Chapter 5, The Mandalorian, The Gunslinger, as this series continues to move into what we thought might be new ground, but wait, we're going back to a place we know and love. Before we talk about this entire episode, of course, make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Droids Pod on Facebook, on Twitter and Instagram. And then, of course, Droids Podcast on Facebook. We're going to try to get that updated. We really should have it be the same on all of them. Why haven't we done that by now, Sam?
Oh, I think we assigned that to Chris.
That's a good, fair point. Then you can email us at droidspod@gmail.com, rate and review us on iTunes, check out YouTube and Droids Pod to see what Ryan has been up to with the Jedi Fallen Order playthrough. But before we get into this episode, this chapter of The Mandalorian, Sam, what'd you think about going back to Tatooine? Regardless of the story, we were at Mos Eisley, we're on the planet, we're back where in places we know and love.
You know, I was just relieved that Star Wars finally found a way to get us back to a desert planet, to be honest.
Yep. They don't do that very often. It's not something that comes up. It's not in the trailers for Rise of Skywalker at all.
Well, I guess my reaction was when I heard they were going back to, when I heard the, you know, Mos Eisley spaceport, come over the radio, I did, you know, I think my gut reaction or my brain reaction was kind of an eye roll of like, oh, really? Like,
yeah.
However, I enjoyed this week's episode. I still don't think they've reached the heights of Chapter 2, but I did enjoy this week's episode, and I thought that this week did a better job than some other chapters with the you'd call them fan servicey moments or like nerdy moments of like call outs. And I thought that the references to places we know on Tatooine, Beggar's Canyon, the Dune Sea, et cetera, those I ended up enjoying them kind of a lot. And I guess I'm happy it was set there as much as I kind of think it's like, oh, come on, come up with something new.
Yeah.
I actually was like, I liked a number of the references that we got. So I was good with it. I don't know. What were your thoughts?
Well, so last week, Ryan came down hard on Chapter 4, and I didn't quite feel as strongly. I enjoyed last week's episode. I didn't quite notice some of the seams that Ryan really pointed out. This week, I noticed the seams. And
one thing
I want to tell you is nepotism in front of the camera rarely works. What in the world were they thinking with Jack Cannavale?
I'm so glad you brought that.
Huh?
I was nervous. Okay. I was nervous that you were about to go after Amy Sedaris, who I found to be a delight in this episode. I was like, this is the perfect use of, like, I guess what you could consider stunt casting. I mean, she's not, maybe, I don't know if Amy Sedaris is like, she's not Brad Pitt turning up at 12 Years a Slave. That's right. I just referenced 12 Years a Slave because it was the first thing I could think of.
The first cameo that you could think of. First big name, small cameo. Not some of these other ones. That, maybe Bill Murray in Zombieland.
Who? Nope. Went right to the... I'm sort of a drama man.
not Hugh Jackman in X-Men Days of Future Past. Or wait, which one?
Huh?
First Class?
Huh? There's lots of better examples. We've already covered it.
I mean, I choose but, actually kind of some bad examples. I'm sure there are better cameos than that.
Look, if you know a cameo, tweet at us on Twitter at DroidSpot. But basically, I thought like Amy Sedaris, who definitely sort of as a person, as a character, you know, her personality as a celebrity is, I think, bigger than sort of like her acting. And I was like, this works great. I love her. I love what she's doing. I love what she's bringing to this. I was very in. Jack Cannavale, is that like of the Bobby Cannavales?
Yes.
Wow.
Which makes me wonder, what
he should take acting lessons from his dad, who's good. Woof. That was rough. That was really rough.
What does Bobby Cannavale have as blackmail for Jon Favreau? Because what in the world was he doing in this show? The writing for him, dialogue-wise, was not great either, but a better actor could have pulled it off. But here's the thing. If you want to introduce a character by having them sit in Han Solo's seat,
yeah,
in the same pose with the same blaster and some for some reason a vest and apparently Harrison Ford's real life earring, what are you thinking if you're going to bring it in and have it be sort of shoddily put together? It just that baffled me, and I know this sort of sounds like a traditional Star Wars fan who's been toxic, don't change what I love, but there wasn't really a purpose for him to do that. It's not like he knows, or maybe he does know, the legend of Han Solo from his time in Mos Eisley in the cantina, because word got around, just like the Mando's line of saying, bring him in warm or bring him in cold, word gets around about what Harrison Ford or Han Solo did during his time on Tatooine, even though it was a smuggler who was all over the galaxy. We know that he sat here. There must be a plaque on the wall. McClunky, Greedo, taken out at this moment here with him, an image. What were they thinking? It distracted me so much from the rest of the episode.
It has a plaque above that seat. I don't know if you actually saw it in the episode. There's a plaque above that seat that says shot at the same time. Because it's famous in the universe that's where one man shot another man, but they fired at the same time.
Yeah, there's no reputation that was built there.
No. Sam, Mike, the iconography you're hitting on is like it. Yeah, it. Here's what I think it highlights for me. Okay, because you brought up the writing, which this was written and directed by Dave Filoni.
Yep.
I do think the episode directing wise, I think the episode was stronger than his.
Yeah.
First episode of the series. Writing wise, you know, it as soon as I didn't know it was Filoni, I didn't recognize it as Filoni, although in retrospect I should have, because I was like, oh, as soon as I saw the name, I was like, this totally feels like a Filoni episode. It's very encapsulated. And it kind of has his beats, his storytelling beats to it. But you know, the dialogue itself, that writing was a little clumsy. But here's what I think, what I'd say about this. This highlights sort of the real sort of magic and luck that we have had as Star Wars fans with the casting of this franchise in general, which is that all of this dialogue is, I mean, it is by its nature, it's the hero's journey. It's pretty straight. It's pretty on the nose. The dialogue in all of the Star Wars movies tends to advance the plot. It tends to be people saying exactly what they're thinking. Or if they're saying something that's not what they're thinking, it tends to be pretty broadly telegraphed, right? It's, you know, as Lucas famously says, you know, these are movies for kids, right? So the dialogue is always a challenge. And I think that highlights what good actors do with that.
Yeah.
And I think you see it episode over episode from some of the supporting cast members who really can settle in and who can actually take something extraordinarily unnatural and clunky and make it sound fine versus, you know, I really do, you know, poor Jack Cannavale.
And I got to correct it. It's Jake, by the way. That was my
Jake.
Mistake.
Oh, sorry. I was, Jake Cannavale. I mean, there was not one moment where he seemed comfortable in the environment. There was not one line of dialogue that came out that sounded like it had character behind it, like it was natural, like there was a personality.
Yep.
It was rough. It was distracting. I think it sounds like for both of us.
Yeah, I couldn't focus on the rest of the episode. I couldn't focus on the story. I know what happened, and I actually kind of like some of the choices in there, but It took me completely out of what I was supposed to be experiencing. And then it made me think, I'm like, because I didn't know at the time. I said, does Jon Favreau have a, you know, late teens, 20s, or mid-20s son? Is this why this guy's in this series? That's the takeaway that I had in the moment.
I did actually have the same thought. I did wonder. I was like, is this kid a Favreau?
It was so strange. And then... But as watching it, you know, you talked about how a good actor can take that dialogue and take it in a different direction. Part of that is Dave Filoni not being the best live action director yet and not having a lot of experience in that area can't help an actor's performance along. I'm not saying that he could have made leaps and bounds difference with whatever Jake Cannavale was doing in this episode, but he could, if there was, say, Deborah Chow or somebody who's worked even a little bit more with other actors, I think you could have seen a little bit better performance.
Mike, let me ask you a question. Okay, if you're working with a kid and they're not really giving you the performance you want, but you know their dad is Bobby Cannavale, are you going to really give that kid a note? No, man, this is a one take. That looks great. That looks great, Jake. No, I'm kidding. I do actually love Bobby Cannavale.
Problem with Bobby.
I'll tell you what. If Bobby Cannavale had been in the role, it would have been like if he were like an older guy trying to crack into bounty hunting.
Wow, now I want to see that episode.
The comedy, like, because here's the thing: there was an attempt at the kind of like odd couple comedy that we had back in Chapter One between IG-11.
Yep.
IG-11 and Mando. There was like I think one of the best sort of timed jokes that Filoni had was like, you know, about the rifle bolt from the blaster and the Beskar stopped it,
mm-hmm.
and then you know the greenhorn kid says, wait a second, I don't have any Beskar armor, yeah. And no, you don't, and it's like half of that exchange was funny. It's, you know, but I do really feel like we're actually starting to like dogpile on somebody who's not here to defend themselves. There was, you know, it's more than just an actor who makes the choices.
Yeah,
it was distracting, but let's actually, my guilt is kicking in. Let's not jump on this guy too bad.
Sam,
right?
I don't know that I can stop, to be honest, but you're right. I don't know.
Be bigger, Mike. Be the bigger man.
You talk
Look,
about
man, I want you to get into the guild. You gotta be nice. That's one of the first things they teach you in the guild. Be nice to your fellow guild members.
To your fellow guild members, but not to anyone who's your bounty. Last thing I will say is that I think, you know, nepotism, it's a big thing. It's a big part of the culture. It works a lot in different places, but when you're under the microscope of being an actor in front of the camera, it's probably the worst place to have nepotism. Unless you're actually talented. You know, worked out for Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's daughter. She's pretty good. Like her a lot, but not here. I'll leave it there.
All right, and that's the final word.
Well, you're trying to be. I respect it, and yes, I'm being very hard on something that it's not entirely on him. One thing I want to say at the very beginning is I love. You can keep on flipping switches in any Star Wars ship endlessly, and I'll enjoy it every time. As he kept walking around, the sound design, you know, just I just love it as you keep on trying to figure out how to get the ship working again. Nice little space battle to start, you know, a little, I would say, not stagnant, but it was couldn't move very well, but we know from earlier interviews they were trying to make sure this ship felt like a Star Wars ship and not just a CGI creation that could do anything.
I think the space battle was fine. The only issue I had with it was I thought the only scenes that showed there was like the editing was a little slower than it would have been in a film, right?
Yeah.
There is, and I actually don't think it's necessarily, or for me it wasn't about the movement of the ship or like the slowness or speed of maneuverability, but it was about like the slowness of the cuts. Like we got, you know, the shots in the cockpit, you know, we're just a fraction longer than they would have been, right? In episode 3 or episode 6 or episode 9 coming up, and we're just a few weeks away. Oh my god. So Yeah, I thought it, but I thought it was good. I thought it was a fun way to start the. I mean, it's starting the episode in classic Star Wars fashion, right? This felt like the opening to any number of the actual, you know, films, yeah. Right? It's like fly over, and you're in the heat of battle. You're in a chase. This is a war. It was cool.
And I liked the line where he said, "This is hey, that's my line," and then he took him out.
Perfect. And
very classic
great,
Western there.
It was reference to chapter one when he says, yeah. "I can bring you in cold or not," and which was the other Filoni directed episode. So I actually liked that it was the same director who actually got to make that callback. That was a fun, like I picked up on that at the end of the chapter, obviously.
And I would say that it felt like it could be breaking the fourth wall a little bit by saying that's my line, but it is something that I think has been done throughout storytelling in cinema for decades, where they're still very aware of I have a catchphrase, so yeah, I'm gonna acknowledge
that. It's also that literally saying that's my line is like a colloquialism. Yeah. I don't think it was like a meta. I don't think it was meant to be meta. You know, I think that's like
well, from here on out, I'll say you pulled a Jake Cannavale. That's my line. That's my line from here on out.
Okay. So I can't beat on. Look, I did a lot of plays in college. I acted in a lot of plays in college, and there were times when I gave, you know, the best performance I could, and I had a sense of how I maybe looked on stage, right? And it maybe wasn't. I didn't necessarily feel that people were going to walk out raving about my great performance.
Sam, what's the best stage performance you've ever seen?
I think, ooh, good call. Maybe I saw, you know who it was? It was, I saw Cillian Murphy in a play called Mr. Man by Enda Walsh at St. Anne's Warehouse. And it's a one-man show, and it was like an absolutely transformative, magnetic performance. I couldn't believe it. That's the best performance I've ever seen.
Well, the way I give you a tip of my cat here is that you didn't try to do a knockoff version of Cillian Murphy in that performance and dress like him and pretend that you were going to be him in your own production that didn't live up to it.
I feel like we need a third droid to cut the tension. Mike and I are I'm worried about us going forward. We're having this huge fight on air. It's so embarrassing.
No, this is entirely on me, just fixating. This is totally on me. All right, let's get back to the episode. You talked about Amy Sedaris. I thought she was great in the role. I still think tonally these shifts between comedic actors who have been brought in is still just throwing me for a loop. Like, it's just, you know, we had Pillboy, the actor Eugene, I can't remember his last name, in the
Cordero.
Last episode.
Cordero.
We had Brian Posehn. We had Horatio Sands, Bill Burr's coming up. It's interesting. It's just, I think it's another thing that kind of pulls you out because you're sitting there and thinking, like, is that Amy Sedaris? It is Amy Sedaris. It's just an interesting choice that has tonally been part of what's been weird to me. But I also think back, and we were talking about it, as we always do, as you just brought up, Sam, Star Wars being for kids, I don't think kids are paying attention to half of what is maybe getting under my skin here in the last few weeks.
No, I don't think so at all, right? Like, I don't know that. Well, there's also a question of, like, you know, whether this is a series for kids, you know? I mean, I know I made the point that Star Wars is for kids in sort of broad terms, but you know, this one definitely is. It's a little bit edgier, it's a little bit darker, it's a little bit, you know,
which to me seems like kind of the perfect thing for that 12 to 13 year old, which is what George has always kind of circled, or I guess 11 to 13 year old, where you're on the cusp of watching some more daring things, some more
you're not ready for The Irishman yet.
No. You're not ready for The Irishman. You're not ready for the de-aging techniques of The Irishman. It's just going to be
too much
for your young, developing mind.
Why does Bobby D look so young? That's what everybody calls him, Bobby D, by the way. That's what the kids... I've talked to a lot of kids recently, and I ask, of course, the question I ask everyone when I first meet them, what do you call... the actor Robert De Niro, just because I like to find out what people... I don't know what this is. This is... Save me, Mike.
No, I think,
get cut off
this bit. You're going with this is that for kids today, it's really a decision between Baba D, and PewDiePie. Those are the two. They're just going
boy.
Between those two, right?
Oh, yikes.
I couldn't think who else is a very big, I guess a streaming star is Ninja. So Ninja or Bobby D, one of those two.
Hey, I look, yeah, I'm old guard. I'm Bobby D all the way. Bobby D or Bobby C. Bobby Cannavale, man.
Hey, I've tried to
what
go away from it.
What an
you're
actor.
You're bringing us back, Sam. You're bringing us back.
I'm just talking about the Cannavales. What do you mean? What's wrong with the Cannavales?
We had
okay,
some,
don't answer that.
We had some other trappings within the episode. The I guess I would call them Watto's droids, but also they're the pit droids. Bring us back in prequels. I thought it was fun. You know what? I before I was on this podcast, I might have been someone you would call a prequel, not denier, just not a prequel fan. And now I go back and I look more fondly on those films. And when you give me a moment where you touch on it, I kind of like it. I think that it was a nice little touch to have them in there. And it wasn't so over the top. They weren't doing constant pratfalls. It seemed more natural skittishness instead of let's bump into everything and fall over.
Yeah, they set it up that they were afraid of the Mandalorian, which was kind of a perfect reason for them to be bumbling.
Yep.
Like they actually motivated it in a way that was really funny. And again, I loved. I know that Amy Sedaris, like, I get what you mean. The tonal changes will like give you a nosebleed in this show, right? Because you're like going from like extreme depths to extreme heights.
I love it.
So I get that. However, I really loved when like I loved the Amy Sedaris monologue when she's like talking to Baby Yoda and she's, you know, she's sort of like half like cooing him to sleep, but then also like, this means I can charge the Mandalorian more and stuff. It's like it felt very Star Wars. It felt that, you know what? Her character and some of her like not just like lines, but actual like line kind of delivery were more reminiscent of like a Han Solo-esque character than what we got elsewhere in the episode. Because it was like, you get the sense that she's like, she's a survivor. She's someone out to turn a quick buck. She's got problems and she'll kind of talk to whoever's around in the same way that like, you know, Han's always like, you know, I don't know, like kind of grousing about things, talking to the ship, talking to Chewie, whatever. Like, you know, yeah. I don't know. I enjoyed that. I thought they nailed that. I thought it was cool to see speeder bikes.
It was.
We get some speeder bike action. And the speeder bike, like, effect, animation, performance, whatever, like, looked like that was one of the first times when I'll say what will make Ryan, the hair on Ryan's neck stand up. I'll say it looked like the original trilogy. Cause like it looked like just a little bit bad, like a little bit green screeny, but like also like it was like, oh, they have the exact speed that the speeder bikes move, like perfect. Like the sand tracking under them looked exactly like, you know, the forest moon of Endor. It was really good.
Yeah, and it's something that's come back. I think we talked about it before. Filoni has done this a few times where he's had speeder scenes on different planets, and it seemed kind of fitting because he did that in, I think, the first episode of Rebels, where Ezra steals a speeder bike. And this just kind of felt like, again, like he, you know, it's sensible that they would have speeder bikes, but it seems like one of those things that he really enjoys exploring. And I thought that was fun. I thought the usage of it throughout when they're leaving the spaceport at Mos Eisley, and then when they're making the run against Ming-Na's sniper, Fennec is, I believe?
Fennec Shand.
I like that whole scene. I thought that was really a well-done one, and it's something that takes what would have been an original concept of, say, from a Western, and then adds this other twist of the flares that are being sent up that maybe they're not particularly just Star Wars-esque flares. You could have done that in some other series, but I felt like I hadn't quite seen something like that, even though I'm sure it exists, where they're charging, trying to distract, shooting off the flares, and that to me was a very fun scene to watch. And I liked that use of the speeder there. And then the entire setup, all right, one speeder's done, what do we do now? How do we get back? It allows some other story for him to have to go and find the Dubek, and then we get the moment that while a well-written one. I think I got to go back and watch it again to get a little bit more understanding of the scene, to not be distracted by what was happening, by the performance. But
Mike, lay off the guy. All right, now you're just getting mean. That scene was fine.
Well, I say it as just like I think that was a nice decision there to have him take out Fennec, which. Is Fennec no longer alive? We don't know. There's a scene at the end that maybe would think otherwise, or at least being checked on by someone. And
someone who's wearing stirrups that make sound on the sand.
Interesting. am I missing? Have we had a character with stirrups before?
No, but I assume that's Giancarlo Esposito.
Oh.
Who we haven't seen 5 chapters into an 8 chapter series, but who was like, headline build.
Well, I'm wondering, that's much more sensible than the first place that my mind went. The first place my mind went was something that I think that they were trying to tease to get all of the speculation and get all the fanboys talking about it is like, oh, it's Boba Fett. He's gotten out of the Sarlacc pit and he's been on Tatooine ever since.
Oh, wait, does he have stirrups?
No.
Does he like
I don't know. If, I don't oh, know okay. if he has stirrups, but I'm just by having a unknown figure walk up at the end of an episode on the planet where we know that he, well, we thought
yeah,
that he lost his
I
life.
Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, I forgot that Boba Fett, like, or Boba's remains
be
here.
This is now another season of The Walking Dead. It's a reanimated Boba Fett that has come to, and he sees a corpse and he's going to
The Walking Fett.
Oh.
The Walking Fed to the Sarlacc.
But so we get the double cross. It seemed like a pretty sensible decision. All right, take out. The one thing I didn't get is that you've taken out Fennec, who's a pretty high bounty on her. Why not bring her corpse with you to cash in on that bounty as well as take out the Mandalorian? Seemed like there was a missed opportunity there.
They made a point. I think there were a couple. You've covered a lot. I really liked the actual encounter scene as well, like the flares and sort of like the riding at them. And again, I really liked the jokes of like seeing his, the strength of his Beskar armor and have it being tested by what we, assume or know is like a high powered blaster rifle. And then it also sets up the flares, which come back. And this is one of the things they've done really well, I think, in chapter 2 and this chapter of the series, where it's like they show you technology in a way that's like organic, so you don't know it's coming back.
Yeah.
And then when it does, it's very rewarding.
Yep.
Like for instance, in another one of the chapters when he gets like the sparrow, like the whatever it's called.
Oh yeah. Whistling birds.
Whistling birds. Yeah. I thought it was, with a whistling bird wrist missiles. That was like, I was like, that was clumsy, right? That's like, oh, we're going to tell you this thing. And so you know it's going to get used. Whereas the others, like, the flares in this episode are shown and stuff. And then I also really liked the sort of the twist of killing Shand. So first of all, the Mandalorian says when he goes off, like, basically, like, keep an eye on her. Don't shoot her. She's no good to us dead. So I think it must be like not a dead or alive bounty. It must
enough.
Be like bring her in alive.
Fair enough.
Is my assumption. But I also, this was one of those things where it maybe should have been obvious, but until the turn happened, I actually didn't realize that Shand was setting herself up to die.
Hmm.
Like as she was trying to talk Toro... Toro Calican. Woof. Come on. As she was trying to talk Toro Calican into betraying the Mandalorian, I like didn't think, oh, he's gonna kill her and do this himself. I was thinking, oh, he's gonna partner with her and do what she was saying. So I actually, I think knowing the plot, I'm like, oh, it should be obvious, but I didn't see it coming, and I thought it was pretty good. Like, when he shot her, I was genuinely surprised. Also because I thought, I think part of that might have been influenced by, like, Ming-Na is a name. Ming-Na is, like, a significant, actor, and, it would have made sense for her to be the primary confrontation of the episode. But it was, I liked... that scene worked for me.
I will say I thought it was going in a different direction. I thought, and maybe this was wishful thinking, and Sam, you know, I know I'm being hard, but I just, this is where my mind was when I was watching the moment. I was like, oh, good. She's going to get the jump on him and take this character out so I don't have to listen to him anymore. Sam, I can really tell that my dislike of this actor is not sitting well with you, and I will try to refrain from it for the rest of the episode.
No, I mean, it's like, I just can't, like, I think his, look, I just, like, I can't keep saying it. Like, I agree that, it, like, he was distractingly bad in the performance, but, like, he's, you know, like I said, like, I don't have any more to add. Like, I can't say it again. You know?
So you brought up that Ming-Na's only briefly in this. Do we think we've seen the end of Cara Dune and we're done with Gina Carano? Was that really just a one episode appearance or one chapter from her?
I think we're going to get all we're going to get is like a second appearance. And I think it's going to be at the end. I think we're going to see Greef Karga and Cara Dune and the Mando group, the group of Mandos, like, come together to help our Mandalorian get out of whatever scrape he's in by chapter 7-8, you know?
Yep.
I was surprised. Well, I was a little surprised we didn't see Cara Dune this episode, but then I was like, well, no, they actually pretty clearly established that it's like they're going their separate ways at the end of last chapter. So, you know, I think the whole idea is that I do think she'll come back. I do think we'll see her again in season one. But I think they were very intentional about, like, not having them. I think it's a setup. You know, I think we're supposed to slowly start to forget about her. And that way, when she shows up, it's like, hey, we loved her. She's back. Yes, she's going to help save our hero. You know, that's, I think, what they're doing with her.
Yeah, I think that's a good call out.
And I think Greef will turn up, you know, as someone who's clearly betrayed the Mandalorian and set him up and then have a change of heart and feel really bad. And he'll end up, you know, grabbing a blaster and standing at his side, you know? That's what I'm predicting.
Baby Yoda has shown up here to join the pod. Just want to make sure that we got Baby Yoda over here.
Hi, Baby Yoda.
Sorry to all the listeners. You didn't know that we had Baby Yoda this week on the pod, but, you know, he didn't have a whole lot to do in this chapter, so he thought he'd join this podcast.
Now, I was going to ask you something. They actually did end up addressing it in the episode. Amy Sedaris' character brought it up. But I was going to ask you, Mike, as a parent, you know, is it chill to leave your baby Yoda in the ship unattended for, I don't know, a couple of days, and a half?
You know, if it's a hot day out, no, you can't do that. No, you can't do it any day. It's not all right.
Yeah, Mike, maybe don't start with just on hot days. Maybe just go right to you can't do that.
No, you can't do it any time. But actually, the thing that I thought as well is, like, you know, where is the spaceship car seat? In the very beginning dogfight, he's just in his pod, not strapped in. They're really not thinking about the safety in basic everyday situations for Baby Yoda, and yeah, he deserves to be called out for that.
I mean, I was trying to remember what they call it. I can't remember what they call it on Star Trek, like the artificial gravity for the ships, you know,
so that
so that you're like always walking on the floor no matter what the orientation of the ship is, sort of.
Oh yeah,
I was like, what, you know, he's fine. You can spiral that thing around all you want. It's not going to be an issue. He's look, I think what we know about this, based on the sort of evasive maneuvers and the fact that Baby Yoda stays in his seat, I think we know that he's at a healthy weight. He's heavier than a porg, which is right where he should be for his age, right? At 50, a Baby Yoda should be, you know, a little heavier than a porg. They're not going to fly up and smack against the window on a tight turn, right? So, I think what we got a lot of, you know, really useful health information. We see that he's sleeping okay. You know, he might be having some, some issues, you know, going down. But, you know, of course, you know, his dad, his father figure was away. So, you know, I think we can assume he's doing pretty good.
Yeah.
He eats. That was one of the best lines in the episode. I just remembered it when she sends off the pit droids to go get him something to eat, And she says, I don't know, something with bones in it is very funny. That was a really good joke, I think. it's kind of dark. It's like, get him something alive and with the bones in so this baby can eat it.
Well, in chapter four, he had a bone broth, right? So they must be something they know that there's just a lot of sustenance, vitamins.
He's very wrinkly. They probably know he needs the collagen. They're probably trying to make sure to get his collagen intake up, because they're like, hey man, we've watched the movies, we've seen The Only Other Time, we don't want you with those early laugh lines and frown lines and upper lip lines and forehead squares, you know. So they're looking out.
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about Mos Eisley and Tatooine. I thought they did an excellent job in recreating the cantina and recreating parts that we had seen. The cantina, when you walked in, it looked really good. But also on the outside of the cantina, when he was walking in the front door, it's the same shell of an old ship that was there in, of course, Star Wars, the original film in 1977. And that was, I liked that they paid enough attention to detail, which you knew they would, but it looked really good. And then they also had the same droid that was on Jabba's sail barge, who I believe was destroyed on the sail barge. Mm. So he didn't have the same voice. Or, wait, did he? He didn't have the same voice, but I don't know if he actually was on the sail barge, because he said, I have use for you on the master's sail barge. So I don't know that he actually was sent on the ship. So maybe it could be the same droid. They just obviously couldn't completely recreate the voice.
Well, Mike, also, I don't know if you're aware of this, but like, droids are also mass produced.
Yes. So that's, but that's the thing though. You go to Tatooine and you have droid. Know. Yeah.
I agree completely. I did think it was really, really well crafted and produced. And I liked that they made a point of showing, you know, this series has used, some CGI aliens and some new creatures and stuff, but they made a point of like throwing in a couple of like clearly big mask wearing humans, like mask with glitter and stuff, that was like, oh, they're specifically saying that in this cantina, this is the type of clientele, and it's a nod, which was great. The only issue I would say, the only thing was, it was like, it was too well lit. It was like too bright.
Oh, yeah.
That felt different to me, but hey, different time of day, the Empire's gone, so maybe they burn the candles a little brighter, who knows.
A little celebration.
Also, you know what's very interesting now, sorry, you're talking about this droid, which I could be misremembering here, but the fact that there's a droid bartender in a place that doesn't serve their kind, it's pretty interesting.
Oh, very interesting. Oh, Sam, good call. Well, maybe change of ownership. They're like, look, we know how much more it costs to have an actual life form bartending, so why not? Let's use a droid. We're changing things up here. New ownership. We're revitalizing this thing. We're going to make sure it's more cost effective, and we're not going to have limbs strewed everywhere across the floor. This will be an establishment welcome to all families and such. They want to get all the customers, all the patrons they can.
We're going to, corner booth, let's patch up that carbon scoring, okay? You know, cover up. Take that plaque down. We don't need to know that there was plaster fire here, you know?
I'm just thinking it actually is like a tourist trap. They've got all the trap things set up there. Like, General Solo sat here once. Make sure to come by and take your galactic Instagram.
That would be... it would be actually funny. I don't know how you would do that, if you would do it as a... if it would need to be a sitcom, or if you could do it as a drama. But the idea of like the celebrity, you know, navel-gazy element of what happens to like the characters in the Star Wars, you know, universe. I guess we have seen the legacy characters, you know, in the newest, you know, the Disney era trilogy. So we kind of know what happens to them, and we know that's not true to form. But I like that idea. I don't know. We should do like a web comic of it or something.
Well, I think of when they first introduced Han Solo in The Force Awakens, and they're like, the smuggler? The rebellion hero. And I think everybody's coming around the galaxy and be like, what's your favorite kind of Solo? I loved him when he was a smuggler. I love him as a general. I don't know why they have that voice, but
I don't know either, Mike, but I'm impressed. I like it. You're a regular Cannavale over there.
Oh, he did it. He did it. Wow. I thought I'd really gone in a direction Sam didn't want, and yet he brought it back. All right, before we end this episode, we've talked now the last 3 weeks about the ball not being moved forward. And I think what we have to do is accept that this is what the show is. The show is not the ball moving forward every episode. The show is these other adventures that he has. And eventually we get the ball moving forward by kind of what we're used to in traditional network television, where the mid-episodes are telling you more about who the character is, having more experience, meeting new other characters who may come back to help later on, like you talked about with Cara Dune. Instead of having a single story that is always progressing forward, we're going to get more of the progress probably in the last two, maybe three episodes, where Werner Herzog is probably going to come back in because he's still searching for the child. We're going to see Giancarlo Esposito. He might be somebody that Werner Herzog is working with. I think it's just that you get these middle chapters that are fun side stories that are reminiscent of old tales that we know from other iterations of the inspiration of Star Wars. And I think as you accept that, it's a lot easier to enjoy this without being like, well, we haven't learned any more about Baby Yoda. We haven't learned any more about what's happening with the Mandalorian and his backstory. We don't know who all is coming for him other than the other bounty hunters and why they wanted Baby Yoda. And we're going to get that probably towards the end of this season to set up what season two will be. And I think as I think about it that way, I don't mind it as much. I don't mind that we're not going to reveal or have the story move forward in that way, because I can enjoy these small side adventures.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up, Mike, because there's some parallel thinking going on here, and I kind of agree with you. I agree with you insofar as I enjoy these sort of side stories, these, you know, non overarching plot line, the less serialized or at least less serially relevant episodes, right? I enjoy that structure and that's fun. But I think they being the showrunners, they being, you know, Favreau and Filoni and Disney Plus, they didn't set this up that way. And I think that's the problem, right? The way that structure works is that the first two episodes or the first episode or even the first three, right? The sort of pilot arc needs to end, and it needs to end with the Mandalorian choosing to be with Baby Yoda and on the run in perpetuity, which maybe that's what they were trying to go for. But it's like that storyline needs to end, and they didn't end it because they left so many threads unresolved. And so you have the first three episodes of the chapters of this series setting up a very clear, very linear, very singular story, right? And it is not resolved. It is very much at the midpoint. And then you have two chapters so far in a row that are not advancing the ball. And I would say even that third chapter really didn't do a ton to advance the ball. But the way you said, you know, if this were going to be the sort of more episodic Lone Wolf and Cub style story, you need to definitively end, you know, he needs to kill the client, you know, at the end of that opening arc, and kind of be like, well, you know, I'm out of the guild, I've screwed things up, but I'm safe, we're safe, and now we're gonna go, and this is my sort of life now, right? And then you can do some things like a surprise, like bring those characters back later and be like, oh no, there was a loose end he didn't consider. What they're doing is kind of having it both ways, which is setting up this like very strong central storyline, but then also trying to do these episodic adventures. And what it does is it does a disservice to these middle episodes that now feel like they're filler, like they're jammed in and they're distracting from the, like, to be honest, they're distracting from the story I'm actually interested in. That's fair. Not the episode's fault, because this episode, again, with the exception of one performer, I think this episode was actually really strong and really enjoyable.
Yeah.
But again, it's like, how many times when I go back through and rewatch, there's going to be probably three episodes, maybe four in the middle that I can just skip.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, in truth, you know, so I agree with you that I would love this to be the format. I would love there to be a less strong central core storyline, and that the show become a little more episodic. And I, you know, again, I love the idea of like a lone wolf and cub style, like man and child, you know, all like moving from planet to planet in and out of danger. Like that sounds like a blast to me. But in order to get there, we need to definitively end the plot line that kicked it off, or somehow give people some kind of resolution, or we need to check in with what's going on. I mean, we haven't seen Werner Herzog in several episodes now, and it's like, supposedly, I would assume he's trying to track this guy down, assume he's going to come back. And if he's going to come back, it's like, why were we not privy to what was going on?
Yep.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, like, structurally, it's kind of clumsy.
And I think we had talked about this, or I might have read a little bit about the last episode, is that the first part of chapter 4 is the only time we've seen something not from the Mandalorian's perspective. You know, it's the only time we've seen a scene without him, where they're doing the krill farming, and then they get attacked by the Raiders.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Which is a bit of a weird way in, when in the prior three episodes, everything had been about the Mandalorian's experience, and everything had been not from his perspective, but showing what had happened to him. And then we step away from that, and now we're back into that, right? There's the scene between the two of them at the end. It just seems, if you stuck to that, it's a little bit easier for them to continue telling that story and then say why you wouldn't have a Herzog cutaway, because we're only kind of living with the Mandalorian. But now they kind of threw that out of the water when they did chapter 4.
Sure. I don't know. There have been shows where it's, you know, the journeyman shows, the Incredible Hulk, Bill Bixby show, or like, you know, I think Kung Fu was, you know, and or Have Gun Will Travel. Like, there's these shows about, the hero, the lead of the show goes from place to place, you know, and maybe there is, season over season, an overarching, like, why.
Yeah,
he's on the run or she's on the run, and what they're trying to find. But again, you don't have, on those shows, you don't have like a pilot episode that is just wildly unresolved that takes the first three chapters. That is very, I mean, this thing was set up very much to be like a serialized, you know,
yeah,
you know, Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, Mad Men story, like episode to episode, one singular mm-hmm. thing. And they're breaking that format. Again, I'm really enjoying this. We're getting new Star Wars every week, and
I'm loving my Mando mornings, I have to say.
I love it too. I love getting up and watching it first thing. I'm still really enjoying, what we are getting from Pedro Pascal. We still haven't seen him remove the helmet, and one day, if we do, and I kind of hope we do, because I think he's a great actor, but his performance is more subtle and more nuanced than kind of it needed to be, and I like that. I do like the show. Just overall, visually, I really like it. I like it design-wise. It's playing in the realm of Star Wars that I really like, with the sort of bounty hunters, scoundrels, you know, that kind of thing. So I don't mean to be down on it when I'm sort of bashing the structure a bit, but you know, I do think that it didn't telegraph to us as viewers what it actually was.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's where, when you're bringing up the fact that you're like, oh, if you know, as I shift my perspective on what the show is, it's really, I'm enjoying it. It's like, yeah, but that's the reason you have to do that.
Yeah.
Like you shouldn't have to do that as the viewer. That's the showrunner's job to get that right, and they didn't, I think.
Well, so it's one of those things where I think there's just going to be this major shift of how did you feel after chapter 4? And because are we now, you know, say, like I said, until maybe episode 7 and 8, are we getting these three episodes or chapters in the middle where they're going to be these side stories, and there's this, you know, you had said chapter 3, you felt a little disappointed that they had not resolved that issue of what he was going to do, or you thought they had resolved the issue in chapter 2, and then he was still making the decision about whether or not he was going to give back Baby Yoda. But it's that big dramatic shift where we then, lose that serialized story happens in Chapter 4. And I wonder if we're going to look back on this and be like, oh, it was that moment where things really changed and it didn't necessarily say that the series was bad, but you either were really invested in what you saw in the first three chapters, and then from there, you either were put off a little bit by that massive change in direction.
That's an interesting question, yeah, and I don't know. I mean, it's really, you know, I wonder if other people are also noticing the difference and feeling a certain way. You know, I guess if you're listening out there and what we're saying is resonating, let us know if you like. Are you leaning towards really liking the sort of episodic, the Xena Warrior Princess version of this show? Are you really liking the more serialized, like long form, slow burn of the show that they've kind of abandoned? Or do you like that it's a mix of both? Like, are you liking that it's what I'm saying is maybe structured a little choppily, but like maybe that's working for you? I'd be really curious to know.
Send us an email, droidspod@gmail.com, Twitter droidspod, Instagram droidspod, and Facebook the Droids Podcast. YouTube, check out Ryan's playthrough of Jedi Fallen Order. Rate and review us on iTunes. Sam, what a pleasure to talk about Chapter 5, The Mandalorian. I think we might end this episode and maybe all future episodes with apologies to Jake Cannavale. I might have gone a little too hard on you, my friend, and I'm sorry about that.
Jake, listen, come in. Jake, lean in. Get in close. Get in close. Look, son, you're doing all you can, and you keep at it. You get back on the speeder bike. You're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Don't let what Mike said. You don't need to worry about what Mike said. He gets a little hot sometimes, and he gets a little upset, and he'll say things like that, but it's going to be okay, kid. You got a dad who can get you a job on any show you want.
Is that your Bobby Cannavale impression?
Oh, no, I was just whispering in the ears of...
if Jakey was your son.
if Jakey was my son. No. Actually, you know, another good... Bobby Cannavale, I saw a great performance. There was a play on Broadway called... I'm going to make this episode explicit. The play was called The Motherfucker with the Hat. And it was Bobby Cannavale and Chris Rock. And I'm trying to remember who it was, the female lead was, but it was a really good play on Broadway. I think it won a few Tonys, and Bobby Cannavale was unbelievably good in it. So,
gonna have to find a way to bleep that out. Thanks for the edit, Sam.
You're welcome.
That will do it for this edition of the Droids You're Looking For, a Star Wars podcast. Oh, we're so close to the Rise of Skywalker. We've got more Mandalorian. This truly is the best time of the year.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. I was trying to think, do they call them years in Star Wars? But I think they do. They said like a half hour this episode, which like I thought was weird. Do they usually say like half hour?
I don't feel like they do.
I was like, oh, they have hours now. Yeah, they have hours now. That's good.
Okay. Good to know.
Good for them.
You know, Sam, I'm glad you brought in a holiday tune with an attempt to make it a Star Wars holiday tune. I was feeling a little bit out on an island last Mandalorian chapter review.